Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell, here as sometimes and usually the case with Russ Chianelli. And today we're going to be talking about geophysics. We're going to be talking actually a lot about water. And you say, well, how on earth did geophysics and water come together? Well, we're going to have that explained to us. And so, Russ, who is our guest?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio distinguished professor Kenneth Virosub, and he's from the Department of Geology at the University of California, Davis.
Welcome to Science Studio. And before we get into geophysics and water and wars that may be fought over water in the future, we'd like to know a little bit about you. How did you become a scientist, and then how did you get specializing in geology and geophysics?
Okay. Well, first of all, thank you both for having me here. As far back as I can remember, I thought I wanted to be a physicist. Because I was a pretty smart kid, and if you were a pretty smart kid in my generation, you were destined to be a physicist. So
don't you just hate Russell? People say, ever since I was three, I wanted to be a physicist.
Well, but ever since I was three, I wanted to be a physicist.
How did you know physics you were a smart kid?
Well,
you
I got
smarter
good grades.
Than your mom and dad?
Yeah. Yeah, and they recognized that, but they were nice about it. Anyway, so I majored in physics as an undergraduate at Michigan, and then I went on to graduate school in physics at Stanford. But while I was an undergraduate, I'd worked for a chemistry professor, so I was elected to Sigma Xi, which is the National Scientific Research Honorary Society. And I was incredibly impressed with myself for having been elected as an undergraduate to Sigma Xi. And it was 1967, and I was at Stanford, and I saw a sign that there was a Sigma Xi lecture. So I thought, oh, well, I'm in Sigma Xi. I should go to this lecture. And it was a man named Alan Cox talking about magnetic stripes on the seafloor, about which I knew nothing. But I went, and I listened to this lecture, and I was just blown away because it was about physics, but it was about the Earth. And I decided, this is really neat stuff. This is what I'd like to do. And there's a long, complicated story that I will not tell you. But basically, I wound up doing my PhD in ultra-low temperature physics and simultaneously doing a master's degree in geophysics.
But when you were 5, 10, 11, you still wanted to – did you do something at home to further this desire?
Actually, the one thing I did try to do was I tried to do something biological. I had this idea about growing algae.
As a
food source.
Oh, mm-hmm. Ahead of time.
Yeah. And I tried to build a device where I could circulate water with sunlight and with artificial light and grow algae.
And?
I wasn't a good enough physicist at that point to get
the
mechanics of it right.
Well, most of the physicists that we have on the program, they say when they're five, they built little anti-grav machines.
Yeah, no, like I didn't build anything. I do remember taking a trip to Brookhaven National Labs.
Okay, so then we've really jumped straight into the ball game. So geophysics is your baby.
That's mostly what I've done, yeah, professionally.
Tell us just very briefly. I mean, the audience, some of them have heard this before, but in your sort of encapsulation, what is this, geophysics?
Geophysics is the use of physics to study the Earth, and that's what was so appealing to me because I already had passed my PhD orals. I knew all the physics. But to see the physics that I already knew applied to real-life situations was what really appealed to me.
And we've talked about earthquakes and different waveforms going through. So you can go the surface waves, the subsurface waves. We've got a lot of people who do that here on campus. So what's your particular niche?
My particular area is magnetic properties of rocks and sediments and soils. When a lava cools or a sediment is deposited in an ocean, it becomes magnetized parallel to the Earth's magnetic field. And we go out and we collect samples of lava flows or sediments.
Okay, so, I mean, it's all stemming from this lecture, the Sigma Xi lecture.
Oh, yeah.
That was fascinating.
That's what got me started, yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit. I mean, I remember reading articles and hearing people talk about one of the most curious features is people say that the poles have turned around, inverted, and so a lot
we're
of the magnetic.
We're about ready to reverse again.
The magnetic.
I don't know if we're about ready to reverse.
No. but therefore, they've seen that there are reversals of the magnetic field in these deposits under the oceans. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that and what it really means.
Well, it was incredibly important in the development of plate tectonics. When we finally figured out what was going on, it made clear that there were plate tectonic processes, that the seafloor was young, it was continuously being created, and we could use the pattern of reversals to determine how old the rocks were.
So how many years between these reversals, roughly?
Well, first of all, they're a random process. So typically we're in one polarity state or another for several hundred thousand years. But there have been intervals of 40 million years when we've been in one polarity state. There have been intervals as short as perhaps 10,000 years when we've been in a single polarity state.
And is it understood why this polarity change takes place?
Yes and no. I mean, one way of explaining it is that the magnetic field is generated by turbulent fluid motions in the core. Core is metallic iron and nickel and maybe some other stuff. And it's the turbulence in the core of this metallic material that generates the Earth's magnetic field. And my own feeling about why the field reverses is that the turbulence becomes particularly chaotic, and so the field that's generated at the surface is no longer the uniform field of a dipole of a bar magnet, and so the field goes into a very disorganized state, and then it reforms into a dipolar bar magnet state, which might be the same as the one before or in the opposite direction.
So this period of flux is
– There's a period of flux.
How long does that last? I mean,
about 10,000 years.
Okay. So it's –
So, yeah, we can tell that it takes about 10,000 years. We can tell that the field intensity decreases by at least a factor of 10 during that period of time.
Can we make any predictive terms about when this might happen
no,
again?
No, because the period is so long. In the last 150 years since we've been making instrumental measurements of the field intensity has declined about 15%. And some people have jumped on this and said, oh, this is evidence that the field is reversing, about to reverse. But one of the things I've done is studied the intensity record of the field. And the field goes through fluctuations of 50% lots and lots of times. So the last 150 years isn't really telling us anything.
And when was the last reversal from geologic
time? The last full reversal was 740,000 years ago.
Ah, so it's on the long
We've
phrase.
Been a long
yeah,
time.
Right.
We've been a long time, yeah. So we may be starting a reversal, but you know, hang around 10,000 years and we'll have an answer.
I mean, I've read some things here where you have this data that goes back millions of years. What about our position in the solar system and the galaxy and the universe? I mean, the gravity forces are always changing. Has anybody looked at that?
In terms of affecting the field?
He thinks – let me put you in sort of in the picture here. Russ has got this theory that our position in the universe and in our own particular galaxy, you know, is having bigger effects than any of us know. For example, it may have an impact on the global climate change, things like that. And so it's an interesting question that – Russ likes to ask a lot of people.
Well, a couple of years ago, I was on sabbatical and I'm working with someone in France and we did some analysis and we thought we saw some kind of a 15 or 17 million year periodicity in the reversal frequency. And at that point, there was someone else whom I won't mention who felt that there should be a 30 million year cosmically mediated signal. And I got a phone call from him, and he said, I hear you've got this periodicity. And I said, yes. And he said, what is it? I said, about 15 to 17 million years. And he said, it's not 30 million years. And I said, no, it's not 30 million years. And he hung up.
You're waiting for another phone call, right? The periodicity of his phone calls, but once a lifetime. Well, are you still working in this area? I mean,
I'm still doing a lot of work. I'm still doing work in that area. To be honest, funding for these is getting very difficult.
Why? Oh, just general.
General.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, success rates at NSF have gone from 30% to 3%. It's just really tough. And other fields are considered more appealing to NSF at this point.
So what would you be doing, or what are you doing?
So what I'm
doing
now,
what would you do more of with
right.
this funding?
So over the last 15, 20 years, for a number of different reasons, I've kind of moved into an area that I call the interface between geologic processes and human activity. So one of the areas I'm interested in is volcanic eruptions that have caused global cooling, of which there probably have been 4 or 5 in the last 1,000 years. And partly as a result of that general interest, I spent a year in Washington, D.C. Actually, I spent 2 years in Washington, D.C., but 1 year was as a senior science advisor in the State Department working on water issues. So I continue to be interested in these. I'm doing some work with the World Bank on low-probability, high-impact events.
Hurricanes. So, I mean, in a sense, you're sort of beginning to move into that sort of geopolitical. I mean, geology and politics,
it is.
Geography,
some of it's
politics.
Geopolitical. Some of it's more how do we deal with some of these issues? You know, how do you prepare for something like Hurricane or Superstorm Sandy?
Well, we did a program a few years ago. We had some people over from the Middle East, and it was all to do with water resources shared between two different cultures with a border, which was the river. I mean, they came here because it was a very sort of a similar environment.
Right.
We've got the Rio Grande, or what passes as the Rio Grande, and we've got two different countries on either side with different attitudes and different religions quite often.
I might have arranged that visit when I was at the State Department. We would arrange for groups from other countries to come, and we'd either send them to the Mississippi to talk to people in the Mississippi or people here. So.
Well, they came.
Or the Columbia River. That's
and it's from Israel and Jordan, or Palestine also. And they lived so close together, but they never met until they came to El Paso. You know, so and it was the commonality of water resources and the use. So let's just take an example. I mean, do you had to deal with this sort of international utilization of water? Let's start there for a little bit.
Okay. Well, there are 262 river basins that are considered transboundary basins that are shared by – means they're shared by at least two countries. In some cases, they're shared by 10 different countries. For example, the Nile, there are 10 countries that are part of the Nile system. And as water has become more and more important, and especially in the developing world, as countries try to make a big push for development – water and power become the critical determining factors in their ability to move forward.
Of course, you had this very historical lake and river between Israel and Jordan.
Of course, and then that's certainly one example. But the Tigris-Euphrates is a particular example. The Mekong is another one, the Nile, and the Indus in Pakistan and India. And so countries get into conflict about water and one country is taking water from a river, and the other country says, you're stealing our water.
It happens right here in the United States.
When
you've got one state takes a little more upriver. But we've got to take a break. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli, and our guest today is Kenneth Verosub from the University of California at Davis Department of Geology. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Niesel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. A friend of ours woke up one morning, poured himself a cup of coffee, and then headed to the bathroom.
To his horror, the right side of his face had collapsed and got worse as he watched. Gradually, his speech slurred and his right limbs weakened. He was having a stroke.
Fortunately, he was rushed to the hospital in time for a full recovery. For stroke victims to increase their chances of recovery, they need to be treated within 3 hours of the first symptoms.
But for that to happen, a person must get to a hospital within the first hour to give doctors enough time to evaluate their condition and treat them. Being able to stretch that window could buy a lot more people time.
A compound called dalfampramine, also known as Empira, could stretch that window by weeks. In rats that had suffered a stroke at least 4 weeks prior, the drug was able to improve motor function in all four limbs.
A clinical trial was planned with a small number of human stroke patients who had a stroke at least 6 months earlier. By then, patients' recoveries have usually plateaued, making any improvement during the study the results of taking Empira.
The drug is already improved for helping multiple sclerosis patients walk. If it can do the same for stroke victims, it'll be the first effective treatment other than physical therapy to restore motor function long after a devastating stroke.
The benefits of developing stroke therapies are obvious. Over 6 million Americans have had a stroke, and 500,000 new cases occur each year. 80% of the cases are from ischemic stroke, which could benefit from this new therapy.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. This is Keith Paddle with Russ Chiannelli and Kenneth Verosub from the University of California, Davis. He's a distinguished professor from the Department of Geology and has been seconded from time to time recently to Washington to do some sort of geopolitics, discuss the utilization of water between societies, etc. Let's really focus in on that then. So it's nice to know that the State Department has got a little think tank, I suppose, to sort of look ahead at where these issues are going to come about. Can you give us some insights into some success that that think tank has had in sort of ameliorating a condition? Or is it too early to talk about that?
Well, nobody's gone to war over water yet, so I suppose that's one indication that there's been some success. Certainly the Nile was one example that State Department was very concerned about because the tensions, particularly between Egypt and Ethiopia over water and over dams that were being built there, seemed to be escalating.
And ancient Egyptian things being flooded.
And well, for thousands of years, the Nile was Egypt and Egypt was the Nile, and Egypt believed it owned the Nile. And that's why it built the Aswan Dam. But the world is different now, and all of these other countries say, hey, some of that water should be ours, and we should be able to do with it what we want. President Meles of Ethiopia, who just recently passed away, had this huge dam-building program and built several dams on the Blue Nile, and Egypt was not very happy about that. And I don't know what will happen now that he's gone, but he had also proposed something called the alternately called the Grand Millennium Dam or the Great Ethiopian Dam, which would have been the largest dam in the world and it would be on the Nile River.
The mother of all dams.
Mother of all dams. And so that's one example.
For us here in El Paso, we've had a similar situation on the border here with Mexico for, mm-hmm. 150 years with our Elephant Butte and water delivered and water not delivered. Have you looked into that at all?
Just scenarios for water conflicts in different places, and the goal was to educate some of the people in the executive branch about the potential for water disputes. And one of the scenarios that we looked at was for 20 years and 40 years out on the Rio Grande.
Back to Keith's question, if you look at that, what do you do about it? If Mexico is not delivering the water and we have contracts where we deliver so many millions.
If there's not enough rain in the Rocky Mountains, there's a lot of variables.
There's a lot of variables.
I mean, you could think of things like international control over the waters, which I don't think people here would accept, but
I think one of the important things is, first of all, to educate leaders that, for example, the total amount of water is not the same every single year, and you can't set quotas based on numbers. And we do have an example in the United States that we pointed to in several instances, and that was the Colorado River and the Colorado River Compact, which was drawn up in 1925 and divided up the waters of the Colorado among all the states and Mexico in terms of absolute numbers. But because of climate change and a lot of other factors.
Like dumping lots of fertilizer from the farms?
Well, that's also an issue, although that doesn't affect the total amount of water, affects the quality of the water. But there's certainly been a decrease in flows during that time. My own state of California jumped in and started taking much more than its allotted share because nobody else was. And then Arizona came online and Nevada came online and started taking their shares of water. So eventually, and it was a long and very difficult negotiation that went on for maybe 5 or 8 years in the 90s, an agreement was reached that the allotment of water was based on the actual – a percentage of the actual water in the river that year and not on some magical number that had been created and picked out of nowhere in 1925.
And that took a long time to come to that simple conclusion.
And that was between states,
right?
Not between countries. But that's got to be part of it.
So in fact, therefore, even between the states, it was difficult to come to an accord. But now that is a model that you say can be
used.
Is it being used elsewhere? Where do you see successful internation discussions?
When you get into the international arena, we have to be very careful because all we can do is sort of lead by example. We can't say you should do this and you shouldn't do that. But I was involved in what was called a strategic dialogue with Pakistan on water. And one of the things we did is we pointed to the Colorado River, the new Colorado River Compact, as a way of dealing with the issues that India and Pakistan have over the Indus River. And there are even issues within Pakistan about how the waters of the Indus are used. So we said, you know, you need to look at what we did here and use that as an example. We're no longer in a position where we can force anybody to do anything. But we can at least say, hey, look, this worked for us. Maybe it'll work for you.
So it behooves us then to really do a good job between this Rio Grande and Mexico.
That would certainly be another example of trying to work out a way of
– Is that working? Sharing. Are we doing a good job with Mexico?
I did not study the Rio Grande in enough detail to be able to say that. But I think attempts – are certainly being made to work out some of these problems.
You know, there's this river that's further east that empties into the Rio Grande. I can't remember the name of it.
Red River or the Pecos?
I forget which one. From Mexico.
Oh, all right.
And there was this argument because they were supposed to deliver so many millions of acre feet, and it didn't happen.
Into the Rio Grande.
Yes.
Yes. That was part of this. I remember that as being part of the study.
But that was climactic rather than, you know, growth.
I don't know why. But anyway.
So, I mean, that's an interesting point. I mean, the idea of having, okay, for the Colorado, then everybody has to agree that's what the watershed, that's the amount of moisture mm-hmm. that precipitated snow or rain, and therefore that's the volume. Yeah. Do we have, an equivalent group of people in the USA and Mexico, they're looking at those sources for these rivers?
I don't know for sure. Okay. I would be surprised if we didn't. I would assume somebody's doing that. But in Colorado, a lot of this work was driven by the people at the tree ring laboratory in Tucson, because what they were able to do is use tree ring records to develop a 500-year record of flow in the Colorado.
Right.
And once you had that, that provided a much better idea of what the variability in the flows were.
So what do you see the future for you in this arena?
I would very much like to remain involved in some of these water issues. One of the things I'm working on is looking at flows in rivers using satellite data. And one of the issues that we often have is that we don't have enough information about the flows. And so when country A says that country B is stealing our water, whatever that means, it often is the case that neither country A or country B will release data about flows in their rivers.
And maybe they don't even know.
Well, they may not know, but in many cases they know. And there are some countries where releasing data about low river flows is considered seditious, and you can go to jail for it. I know people who cannot talk about what they're doing because it's considered treason to release that data.
Sounds like talking about global warming in Texas if you work for the government.
Well,
we'll leave that alone.
I don't know if we want to go there. Yeah.
Well, it's always good to bring out these points.
But getting better data on flows, that's a place where the United States could be a useful third party. Okay, we go in and we use satellite data, and this is what I've been trying to develop, some methods to do this, where we could actually go to country A and country B and say, look, this is what the flow record in these rivers has been over the last 5 years or 10 years or whatever, and either there is evidence of reduced flow or there is no evidence of reduced flow, or the evidence, the reduced flow is due to climate, and we can show that. So that's a place where real fundamental scientific observations could be provided by the United States and help this.
And the implication is that that's not available quite yet. We don't have from space.
We have the technology to gather the data, but the methods for interpreting it still need to be developed.
Okay. Now, we got a few minutes left, and I know Russ has got this geophysics question that he's burning to ask.
Yes. I want to know what is the force that makes faults slip, and I'll tell you why. It's a water issue. I recently wrote a blog because in Pittsburgh, because of fracking, they had small earthquakes. But I remember because in 89, I actually was in San Francisco in an aftershock. And there were scientists there that were trying to lubricate the faults so that they would move more slowly. Could you say something about that?
Way back in the 70s, there was a proposal, even before the 70s, there was evidence that injecting fluids into old oil wells to stimulate production could cause small earthquakes. So there was a suggestion that, well, why don't we drill a lot of holes along the San Andreas Fault, inject fluid, generate earthquakes, and remove the stress.
Has it been tried?
No, it never got tried because there was one problem was liability. Suppose you were in the middle of doing this.
And a big one occurred.
And a big one occurred. Do you want to get the bill for the $40 billion in damage that this would cost? The other one, which is a better geophysical argument, not a legal argument, is that the magnitude of an earthquake represents the energy released, but it goes up 30 times every time you go up one in magnitude. So if you want to try and trigger a lot of magnitude 6 earthquakes in order to avoid the energy that would be released in a magnitude 8, you'd have to trigger 1,000 magnitude 6 earthquakes. And if you were looking at 3 Richter magnitudes, you're talking about 30,000 earthquakes. And it just isn't even feasable to be talking about.
And a 6 is quite significant.
A 6 is significant.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, that's a very interesting
but
idea.
But aren't there some physicists, geophysicists, actually putting rocks together under pressure and lubricating to see what the forces really are?
Well, there are experiments that have been done. People have tried to drill into the San Andreas Fault. It was less successful an experiment than they had hoped. There are people who do that in laboratories. There are people who compress rocks and squeeze rocks and change the fluid in there. And fluid is clearly important. I mean, it's clear that injecting fluid can lubricate a fault. Now, how you actually translate that into something controlled.
The whole feature. But we know how to control Science Studio. We finished. So I'd like to thank you very much, Kenneth Verosup from the University of California in Davis, distinguished professor of geology and someone that's worked very close with government and showing the role that the government has in really being able to set new directions and think long thoughts.
It's been a great visit. I wish we had more time. And thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
Thank you.
And we will be back next week. And everybody can listen to it. We will be back next week with another Science Studio. So have a good week. And we look forward to you hearing us again. Bye-bye.